This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents I Love Capitalism, An American Story. This is the author, Ken Langone. To my wife and sons, with my everlasting love and gratitude. Acknowledgements. I have enjoyed writing this book because it gave me reason to reflect on all the wonderful memories of my life. I've been blessed to have so many caring people help me as I've traveled life's roads. Their encouragement, support, and interest in me have been big factors in my life. First and foremost is the importance of my faith as part of my life's journey. Whenever I was in a tight spot or facing difficult circumstances with little or no chance for a good outcome, my faith kept me going. I know I am more sensitive to the plight and needs of others because of my faith. My spiritual beliefs dictate no less than that. I would be a shadow of myself without my faith in God. The luckiest day of my life was that Monday evening in early June 1954 when I first set eyes on the love of my life, Elaine. Counting a 2-year courtship, we've been together for 63 years. Wow. When things went well, Elaine cheered me on, and when things weren't so good, she was there to encourage me to stay the course and to let me know that she would always be there for me, win, lose, or draw. She's been my life partner, my soulmate, and my best friend. My love for her grows with each passing day. One of the great blessings God bestowed on me was bringing Elaine into my life. Most of what I write about probably never would have happened had Elaine not been with me. I am forever hers. My parents, John and Angie Langone, were the very best parents a child could have. They gave my late brother Michael and me the one thing that matters most to a child, unconditional love, and lots of it. My brother died much too young, but not before he taught me my prayers and helped me to do all my Cub Scout projects. My lasting memory of him is as my protector. I wish our Lord had given us more time with him. Mom and Dad worked hard so that we could have a better life. They taught values by living them, and they stressed the importance of hard work and education. While they struggled financially, they made personal sacrifices to make certain we had plenty to eat, a warm and comfortable home, and happy things to look forward to. Every day that goes by, I miss them more and more. Elaine and I are blessed to have had our Lord send us 3 fine men, Kenny, Bruce, and Stephen. I know I'm a better person because they are my sons. Their love and respect for me is a source of great strength. They've always encouraged me in all my endeavors and have not allowed our accomplishments to diminish their humility or their caring for others. My one regret is that my career kept me away from home more than I would have liked, but thank God, Elaine made up the difference. Every time the boys and all together, the first thing we do is kiss and hug, and we end every phone call with an expression of love for each other. It doesn't get any better than that. We're also blessed with loving and caring daughters-in-law, Jessica and Young, and 2 grandchildren, Manny and Sophia. I hope and pray the examples we set for them will lead them to happy and productive lives. My parents-in-law, Marion and Dick Abbey, and my sister-in-law, Janet Ryder, accepted me into their family as a son and brother rather than as an in-law. Their kindness, thoughtfulness, and generosity knew no limits, and my father-in-law enjoyed a special place in my career, especially as he helped me get started on Wall Street. His wise counsel and insights saved me from many mistakes I might otherwise have made. No one could have had kinder or more loving in-laws than I did. Reflecting on that early years of my life, I remember the love and support of all my extended family, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, my cousins. I remember the family gatherings every Sunday at 1 p.m. at Grandma and Grandpa Larcella's in Port Washington. The aroma of the gravy, not sauce, the meatballs and sausages, the brajol, the fresh bread from Frappola's bakery down the street, the table that no matter how many were there always had room for one more, and after lunch each of the grandchildren performing in the family rendition of Ted Mack's Amateur Hour. Most of all, I remember the love, respect, and affection we held for each other. How kind God was to send me to such a warm and loving family. There are many people in my professional life that have been so important to what I've accomplished, none more so than my assistant and friend Pam Goldman. There can't possibly be anyone more challenging to work with than me, and Pam pulls it off virtually flawless, as she's done for 25 years. I have a bad habit of saying yes to too many things, and Pam always makes sure things work out. She can keep more balls in the air than anyone I know, and she does it always with a smile and good cheer. I am grateful to her beyond what any words can describe. And then there was my friend and driver, Alvaro Gallego. Alvaro has been with me for more than 25 years, and no matter what the demands of my crazy schedule are, he's always there. Alvaro is one of the best examples of what a hard-working, dedicated person can accomplish if he applies himself and takes advantage of everything our great nation offers. Alvaro es mi amigo. Although in the beginning I had great trepidation about writing this book, the experience turned out to be special in every way possible. My collaborator, Jim Kaplan, was a kind and thoughtful partner. Every suggestion he made, every one, improved the book. His commitment to clarity and meaning always brought my thoughts to the points I wanted to make or the story I wanted to tell. In addition to that, he is a superb writer who has an incredible command of the King's English. We started on a purely professional basis, and we ended up enjoying each other, having fun, and becoming good friends. The entire group we worked with at Penguin Random House made sure we kept the trains running on time, and my team, Adrian Zackheim, Mary Sun, Will Weiser, Tara Gilbride, Margot Stamos, and Catherine Valentino, have been sensitive to my purpose in writing this book, but firm when it came to issues they knew more about than I did. I could not have had a better agent than Bob Barnett. He was thoughtful, thorough, and realistic, and he made certain there was always a meeting of the minds. I am grateful to the entire team for this most positive publishing experience. As you will hear in the book, Yankee Stadium wouldn't be able to hold all the people who helped me in my career. It's likely that I've forgotten some of them, not because they didn't make the cut, but rather because my memory is not perfect. In advance, I apologize to them for this oversight. I thank every person or group that's mentioned in this book for playing a role in my life and my career. Along the way, they guided me, helped me, advised me, or supported me. For that, I am most grateful. The mistakes I've made all have been of my own doing. The world belongs to risk takers. Ken Langone. A kid once said to me, "Money doesn't buy everything." I said, "Well, kid, I was poor, and I can tell you right now, poverty doesn't do a very good job either." Chapter 1, I Owe Bucknell $300. This book is my love song to capitalism. Capitalism works. Let me say it again. It works. And I'm living proof. It can work for anybody and everybody. Blacks and whites and browns and everyone in between. Absolutely anybody is entitled to dream big. And absolutely everybody should dream big. I did. Show me where the silver spoon was in my mouth. I've got to argue profoundly and passionately. I'm the American dream. I grew up in Rosin Heights, Long Island, during World War II and just after. There was never much money. My father was an excellent plumber, though not a financially successful one. He lived from paycheck to paycheck. Because he couldn't make enough to provide for the family, my mother had to go to work. She got a job at the school cafeteria, and a little bit she brought in helped make ends meet. But I didn't realize that I was poor, and I had a wonderful childhood. Just over the hill from Roslyn was a vast tract of hills where sand and gravel were mined. The area was called Cow Bay, and Cow Bay sand was much sought after for all kinds of construction in New York City. Roads, sidewalks, building infrastructure, any place concrete was used. Both my grandfathers came over from Italy when they were young, and both of them worked in the sand pits. It was dangerous work. There were avalanches all the time. My father's father, who had a good business head, also had a store in the pits, the company store, where he sold the miners and families vegetables and canned goods and you name it. And he bought real estate. Owning property was the name of the game for immigrants, the road to riches. My grandfather bought a lot of properties that eventually became very valuable, but then in 1932 he was killed by a car. Nobody ever found out who hit him. After he died, his sons fought over who was going to pay the bills on the properties, and none of them did. So the real estate was sold to cover tax liens. My father's father died 3 years before I was born, and my father's mother died in 1919 in the flu epidemic, so I never met her either. My mother's parents I knew. My maternal grandparents were working people. My grandmother stayed home. My grandfather left school when he was 6 years old and never went again. When he died in 1952, at the age of 72, he couldn't read or write, English or Italian. My grandfather was a peasant. He was a lovely man, and from the time he was 6 years old until the day he died, he had a shovel in his hand. His right hand was totally deformed. The thumb had lost the ability to bend from 60 years of holding a shovel. His only entertainment was the opera on Saturday afternoons. He would work all week at the sand pits, then work odd jobs on Saturday morning. When he came home, my grandmother would have the bath ready for him, and he'd clean himself up. He always wore a vest, suit pants, and high-top black shoes, the kind with the hooks and eyelets. When the shoes got too old, they became his working shoes. He would take his bath, get dressed, and eat lunch. He was a vegetarian. His favorite meal was fried peppers and potatoes and a piece of bread and a little bit of homemade wine. Saturday afternoon, he'd eat his lunch. Then he'd go under the arbor. He never owned a house. He always rented and listened to the Metropolitan Opera, sponsored by Texaco, on radio station WJZ. Last year, I was invited to the Metropolitan Opera's performance, A Love O'Hanlon. And I had dinner beforehand with the chairwoman of the Met, Ann Zip. All through the meal and the performance, I was thinking to myself, holy smokes, if my grandfather could see me now. There was a man who lived in Beacon Hill, a nice neighborhood. His name was Mr. Davis. He was some sort of official for the state of New York in the transportation department. My grandfather used to work on weekends at Mr. Davis's house. He would cut the lawn, do pruning and stuff. And Mr. Davis got him a job working on the roads. In those days, in the winter time, they didn't have mechanical sanders. They had two guys in the back of a truck throwing sand over the side onto the snowy roads. That was one of my grandfather's jobs. It was steady work, and he had better benefits, such as they were. They weren't much, but at least it was better than the sand pits, and it wasn't as dangerous. Though there was always a chance, especially at night, that one guy might hit the other with a shovel by accident. My grandfather was working at Mr. Davis's house on a Saturday in August of 1952 when he reached for a branch to cut it, and he had a stroke. He died 4 days later. Clearly he had AFib, atrial fibrillation, but they didn't have Coumadin then. They didn't have beta blockers. I have AFib, and I take a blood thinner. History, genetics. My parents, Angelina Teresa and John Francis Langone, Angie and John, were also very simple people. Neither of them ever got close to graduating from high school. My mother dropped out in the seventh grade. My father didn't want to work in the sand pits, so he went to trade school and learned to be a plumber. But for 4 years during the Depression, 1930 to 1934, this was before I was born, my father didn't work at all. Not only because of economic conditions, but also because of his health. He had colitis, and he was also manic depressive. For 4 years, my parents effectively relied on the help of lots of relatives and friends. By the time I was born in September 1935, my father was working again, but my parents were struggling financially. During World War II, my father worked in the Jacobson Shipyard in Oyster Bay, putting plumbing in ships to be used in the war effort. My mother volunteered at the elementary school across the streets from our house, Roslyn Heights Elementary School, helping to feed what were then called undernourished children. The government sent surplus food to feed these poor kids. After she'd done this for a few years, they opened a cafeteria in the school for all the kids, and they asked my mom if she'd like a job. Every morning, she would make me breakfast and fix my lunch ahead of time. Always the same thing, my favorite, American cheese on white bread, and then walk to work in the cafeteria. My mother was an incredibly sensitive woman. She would identify kids who she knew were having a tough time, whether they had mental problems or learning problems, whatever it was, and make a special effort to be good to them. I never wanted to eat in the cafeteria because my mom worked there, so I would come home every day for lunch. Sometimes I brought my friend home with me, Arthur Kimball, a black kid. His nickname was Bubba. When my mother knew Bubba was going to come home with me, she would make him a sandwich too. Our address was 58 St. Mark's Place, Roslyn Heights. My parents bought the house in 1944 for $4,000. I can remember my father getting the mortgage. The payment was something like $28 a month. It was a small house on a 50 by 100-foot plot of land, backed up against the hill that led down to the railroad tracks. The house had an unfinished basement with a coal furnace. On the first floor, there was a dining room, a living room, and a kitchen, with a little pantry. In the pantry was an icebox. The man who used to bring the ice came every 3 or 4 days. He had a piece of canvas on his shoulder, and he had ice tongs, and he had a chunk of ice sitting on the canvas. The icebox was wooden, and it had two compartments, one for the food on the bottom and one on top for the ice. Upstairs, there were three bedrooms. My brother Mike, he was 5 years older, and I stayed in one. My parents stayed in another, and from time to time, my parents would rent out the third bedroom, say if there was a new school teacher who needed a place to stay before getting settled. My father found work as often as he could. He was a union plumber, Local 457, the Plumbers Union. So if he was on a job and the job wound up, he'd be out of work until he found another. Dad was very meticulous and neat. Whenever a job ended, he'd go home, tell my mother, and she'd wash his coveralls. They had an old-fashioned washing machine, the kind with the agitator that went back and forth, and a hand-crank wringer on top. The next morning, his coveralls would be nice and folded, and he'd take his metal lunch pail with a thermos in it and go out in his car and look for union work. He'd drive all over, from job to job to job, and just ask. If he found a job at 11 o'clock in the morning, he'd say, "Can I start now?" And usually the foreman would say, "Sure, you want to start now? Start now." Local 457 used to meet in Glen Cove, two towns over. The guys in the union hall liked my dad. But one day the union delegate came to my house and said, "You know, Johnny, it's not fair. We've got guys down at the hall who are sitting there for days on end, and you're always getting a job." My father said, "Look, I've got two children. I need to pay my bills. When I lose a job, I can't sit at the union hall playing pinochle, waiting for a boss to call in for a plumber. I get in my car and I go look for work." That's what the union plumbers did. They'd sit there waiting for work and play pinochle all day, then go home. "I'm in the union," my father told the delegate. "I pay my dues. The only difference is I don't wait for somebody to call me. I go find them. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing." The union officials didn't like it. That was one measure of control they wanted to have over the members. My dad worked as a self-employed plumber for a couple of years, 1948 to 1950. But he had a bad problem. He couldn't send people bills. He'd send someone a bill 3 years after the work was done. He'd finished the work long ago, and the person would get the bill and say, "Hey." It wasn't out of any charitable impulse. He was just a bad businessman. He'd use his credit to the extent he could at the supply house, and it was only when he reached the point where he had no more credit that he'd start sending people bills. I remember my brothers used to type them out for him on a small Smith Corona portable typewriter, on those forms he'd had printed up. My father used to sit next to my brother and say, "Okay, two fittings, a half inch by three-quarters inch, 14 feet of copper tubing, and my brother used to send the bills. My dad had good initiative but poor follow-through. I was different. I began working at 11. I was always on the lookout for opportunities, and I loved making money. I started out delivering newspapers. Then one Christmas, I took some of my paper delivery money and went to a greenhouse where they were selling Christmas trees for 75 cents each and bought a couple dozen. I had a broomstick with me, just a stick without the broom head, and two kids I'd hired for $0.50 each. We slid all the wreaths onto the broomstick. Each kid took one end, and we went door to door. I charged $1.50 apiece for the wreaths and netted a nice profit. My mother said to me one night, "You know, you're going to be very successful." I said, "How's that, Mom?" She said, "Because money skips generations. Your father's father was very successful. Your father and his brothers did the best they could, but not much came of it. Now it's your turn." My dad had a panel truck. He bought it from a company called John Wagner and Sons Tea and Spice and had it spray-painted forest green. He called it a route truck. It had no passenger seats. Every Sunday, the four of us, then the three of us, Mike joined the Army right out of high school, would get in my father's truck and go to my grandmother's for lunch in Port Washington. My father drove, my mother sat next to him on a milk box, and I used to sit in the back where the tools were, where the guy that delivered the tea used to keep the tea. In Roslyn Heights, there was a section called Roslyn Estates, where the rich people lived. If you took the shortcut to Roslyn Estates, you'd come out at an intersection, Port Washington Boulevard and Northern Boulevard, and then you'd make a right onto Port Washington Boulevard to get to Grandma's. And every time we drove through Roslyn Estates on Sunday, my mother would say to me, "Would you like to live here one day?" And I'd say, "Yes." And she'd say, "Well, then you've got to work hard and get an education." And I listened. I knew damn well I didn't want to be poor. I wanted to be rich. I had an after-school job at a butcher shop in Roslyn, and after work every night from 6 to 7, I'd go work in a little store that made rotisserie chickens, cleaning up the grease from the rotisserie spits. The guy who owned the butcher shop didn't know I was helping the chicken guy because he thought they were competitors. When I was 15 in 1950, a supermarket called M&H opened down the street and across the tracks from the butcher. And I moonlighted there, too, helping them set up a store, putting canned goods on the shelves at the same time I was working for the butcher shop. I caddied at the golf course. I started my own landscaping business, cutting lawns. When I got to be bigger and stronger at 16, I got a summer job as a day laborer in road construction. I was a hard-working little bastard. Shit, man, as long as I'd get that money in my pocket, I was okay. I was always on the lookout for opportunities. Next to the butcher shop I worked in was Altman Liquors, run by one of the few Jewish families in Roslyn Heights. One day, Lenny Altman, he was a terrific baseball player, said, "How would you like to work for me two nights a week?" The garbage was picked up Wednesday and Friday, and Lenny had all these empty cardboard boxes out back that the liquor came in. So on Tuesday and Thursday nights, I would take the boxes and walk them a couple of hundred yards to the base of a big electrical tower that carried the electricity from the powerhouse in Glenwood Landing up into the communities. Right at the foot of this tower, that's where I used to leave the boxes, and the garbage truck would pick them up the next morning. I don't remember how I found out, but I learned that the garbage guys used to take the boxes and break them up and sell them to a paper scrap dealer for money. This was just after World War II. So I went to Lenny. He paid me $1 a week, 50 cents a night. I said to him, "Look, I'd like to do what these guys do, sell the boxes for scrap." I said, "You don't have to pay me any more, Lenny. Whatever I make from the boxes will be my salary." 4 years later, I'm out of high school, and I get a call from Lenny. Now, I'm not working in the butcher shop anymore. I'm working for Bohack, part of a chain of supermarkets. I go over to see Lenny, and he hands me an envelope. He says, "I hear you're going to go to college." I said, "Yeah, I hope so." He says, "I've been holding this." And he hands me an envelope stuffed with dollar bills. Every single week, he'd been putting a dollar he would have paid me in the envelope, and now he gave it all to me. He said, "Here, I hope this helps you in college." When I say I had the most wonderful childhood in the world, I mean every word. My parents gave me the one thing that a kid needs more than anything else, unconditional love. They were smart people, but they were ignorant when it came to formal learning, so they didn't press me academically. They just wanted me to go to school, and they had one dream, that I would go to college. My brother never went. He was not a student. But the problem was that even though I was a bright kid, I wasn't a good student either. I was never academically curious in high school. I didn't apply myself at all. I did the absolute minimum. I was too busy having fun and working at all my various jobs, the butcher shop, Bohack, caddying at the country club, selling Christmas wreaths. Oh, I was a pistol. I remember I convinced a guy who owned a dry cleaner in town that I could put in a lawn at his house. And I made him order humus and soil and peat moss. And then I got involved with a girl and I never went. And the guy had mounds of shit sitting in front of his house. I was just a kid. Math came easy to me. I was always good with numbers, but that was it. College was my parents' dream for me, not mine. In my senior year, 1953, I didn't have a dream. I just had hormones. That year, there was a girl I was crazy about who wouldn't give me the time of day. The logical next step, my 17-year-old brain told me, was to join the Marines. Maybe I'd get sent to Korea, I thought. I could become a war hero and show her. The problem was that I was young for my grade. I wouldn't turn 18 until September after I graduated, so I would need my parents' permission to enlist, and my father was furious at me for not wanting to go to college, and my mother wouldn't give me a permission either. She said, "No, I have one son in the service already. When you're 18, you can do what you want. I'll at least have a clear conscience that I didn't let you go before." Then Eisenhower screwed me up by ending the Korean War that summer. I had some friends in Port Washington who had gone to Bucknell, three guys a year or two older than I, and that spring they invited me up for a house party weekend. I got there Friday night and had a hell of a good time. The next morning while my friends went to class, Bucknell had classes on Saturday morning, but there were going to be more parties Saturday afternoon and night and Sunday morning. They said, "That building over there is where the registrar is. The guy that admits kids to Bucknell. Go see him." It was their idea, not mine. House parties were great. I wasn't thinking about actually going to college. "Just go see him," they said. "Keep you busy." So I went. Why not, I thought. So I walked in and met this guy, the registrar. His name was George Faint. I must not have looked too enthusiastic. I was also hungover. He said, "What are you here for?" I said, "My friends thought I should come and talk to you." I told him I was about to graduate from high school. "Well, what are you going to do next?" he asked. "I'm going to go into the Marines," I said. "Let's talk a little bit," he said. We talked a little bit. If anything, I was brutally honest. I told him I didn't like school. I didn't like studying. He started asking me some questions, and I guess he could see that I had a brain. So I left, and then the next week I get a letter from him telling me that if I wanted to go to Bucknell, he'd like to offer me a spot. At the bottom of the letter, he wrote, "In college, you'll have to work much harder than you did in high school." Apparently, he'd called up my school, and I guess somebody at the school said, "Look, this kid is bright, but he's sort of listless." Anyway, this was when I told my mother, "Mom, I think I'm going to go to college." I guess I had mixed feelings about it. And bear in mind that Bucknell cost $2,500 a year. It was going to be a real struggle for my parents to send me. My father was still so angry at me for having wanted to join the Marines and now for being kind of half-hearted about going to college that he didn't go to my high school graduation. Graduation night, a Monday night in June 1953, I walked up in my cap and gown and the principal of my high school, Mr. Ross, hands me my diploma. And then, this was a tradition, my friends and I, along with most of the other kids in our class, all went out to Montauk Point to celebrate. The next day I come home at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I walk in the living room, and my mother's sitting there bawling. My first thought was, "Who died?" She said, "Nobody died." "What are you crying for?" I asked her. She says, "You're going to flunk college. You're going to flunk out of college." I said, "What are you talking about?" "Mr. Ross told me last night that you're going to flunk out of college," she said. My mother, in addition to being in charge of the elementary school cafeteria, cooked there. And from time to time, she made spaghetti Italian style, and it was so good. As good as you'd get in an Italian restaurant. And whenever the teachers from the other schools knew it was on the menu, they'd all go up there to eat lunch. My mother knew all the teachers, including Mr. Ross, the principal of the high school. And on my graduation night, Mr. Ross went up to my mother and said, "You know, Angie, you and your husband work so hard for what you have. I have to tell you, you're wasting your money sending this boy to college, because he's not college material." And that was why my mother was sitting in the living room bawling. I said, "Mom, I'm not going to flunk out of college, I promise you." Now, let me tell you how close I came to breaking my promise. My dad did extra work at night and on weekends. I kicked in from my various salaries, and we managed to scrape together the tuition for Bucknell. That September came, and off I went on my own for the first time in my life. For a while, I had the time of my life. It was liberating. It was fun. My God, it was fun. Parties every weekend. Nobody telling you when to go to bed. Nobody telling you when to get up in the morning. But there was another piece to it, an uncomfortable piece. I would drink beer and laugh with my friends, but when the parties were over, I felt alone, more left out than any time before in my life. Bucknell was full of waspy kids with money, the sons of doctors and lawyers and business executives. And here I was, an Italian-American kid from the wrong side of the tracks, Long Island, the son of a plumber and a cafeteria worker. I can remember being uneasy, telling people what my mother and father did, ashamed, inferior. I desperately wanted to be one of the crowd, but which crowd? All the fraternities used to rush during the first semester, and I made it a point to visit all of them and to take full advantage of their hospitality. There was a Jewish fraternity called Sigma Alpha Mu. They called it Sammy. To this day, I have a lot of good friends who were in that house. Anyway, at the beginning of rush week, the guys at Sammy offered me a pledge pin. "What's this?" I asked. "I thought you had to be a Jew." "You're not?" they said. I shook my head. Well, they grabbed that pin out of my hand so fast you couldn't believe it. But thank God for Jewish guilt. They had the best food on campus and plenty of it. That's something I think both Italians and Jews have an affinity for. We both like to eat, and we like to eat well. Anyway, steak night was Thursday night every week, and they'd always invite me. They had these thin T-bone steaks, platters of them. My mouth waters at the memory. Ultimately, I joined Sigma Chi because I had friends there. Now, it didn't matter where I was from or what my parents did. I was a Sig. I'd found my crowd, and I blended right in. And the fun continued. Bucknell had a policy in those days, and it was a good one. Halfway through the first semester of your freshman year, you'd get your grades, and so did your family. Today, the parents can't even get the grades. It's against the law for the school to give them. I don't get it. I know what I did with my sons. If I couldn't see their grades, they could pay for their own education. When the bill comes, I told them, "You sign the check. I'm done." Anyway, I had a course in economics, Economics 101. The textbook was Paul Samuelson's book. It met on Tuesdays and Thursdays, in sections. Then every Saturday, all the classes met together in the auditorium with a professor. Every once in a while on Saturday, this guy, Russell Headley was his name, would give us a blue exam book and a generic question and say, "Tell me about this." A couple of weeks before Thanksgiving, he gave us one about the theory of supply and demand, which is a basic point in economics. The Saturday before break, at the end of class, Headley said, "Before we break, is there a Mr. Langone in the room?" I raised my hands and thought, "Oh, shit. A couple of hundred kids in the room, and he calls my name. Oh, no. I want to see you after class," he said. Class ends. I walk into his office. He was the professor, intimidating guy. He takes my blue book, and he throws it on the desk. "That is the worst English I've ever read in my entire life," he says. He lets that sit for a minute while I squirm in my chair. Then he looks at me and says, "I had to struggle to figure out what you were saying, but it's clear to me that you really understand economics." That was interesting. I had had to struggle to figure out what I was saying, I didn't know if anybody else would actually understand what I meant. "Tell me something, Mr. Langone," Headley said. "Has anybody ever told you you're stupid?" "Yeah," I said, "a lot of people."
"Teachers?"
"In high school, sure." "That's a shame," he said. "But the worst part is that you believe them." He looked at me. Then he said, "How are you doing in all your other courses here?" "About as good as I'm doing in yours," I said. "Well, I guess you're going to be out of here in January," he said. He looked at me.
"Do you want that to happen?" he asked.
"No," I said. "What are you going to do about it?" "I don't know what to do about it," I said. "Well, tell me about your other classes," he said. So I did. And Headley said, "If I make an effort to talk to your other professors, will you do your part?" "What do you want me to do?" "Work your ass off." And that's what Russell Headley did for me. He went to all my other professors and said, "Look, I think this kid is a diamond in the rough, and I think we ought to make the effort to try and pull him out of his nosedive," which, by the way, was totally self-inflicted. Nobody pushed me into a nosedive. I voluntarily dove in. Headley did another important thing for me. When I entered Bucknell, I enrolled in a Bachelor of Science program. You didn't have to take a language or any liberal arts courses. Quite frankly, the BS program was easier than the BA, and that was what I wanted. I had very little intellectual confidence at that point in my life. Professor Headley felt I could do more. He thought I would be better served intellectually if I took liberal arts. So I switched programs. I took philosophy, art history, even Spanish. I dropped out of Spanish in high school, in part because I didn't like the teacher, but mostly because I couldn't seem to wrap my head around the conjugation of verbs. Suddenly I was understanding verb conjugations. I was really enjoying philosophy and literature and art history. My curiosity was blossoming. I'm forever in debt to Russell Headley and Bucknell for that. And then, just like that, I almost blew the whole thing. Every January, just before the semester ended, Sigma Chi had a weekend party called the Bowery Brawl. It was a theme party. You were supposed to dress like a bum or worse. Guys competed to come up with the most original costumes. I made a new friend in the fraternity, a fellow pledge named David Parker, a great guy. We're still close friends to this day. Anyway, one night in early January, David and I are in the fraternity house with some other pledges, getting pie-eyed on illegal beer. Drinking age was 21 in Pennsylvania. We were just 18, and we're laughing about what our costumes are going to be. And suddenly David says, "I'm going to go as a shit." "What do you mean you're going to go as a shit?" I asked. "I'm going to dye a pair of Long Johns brown," he says. "I'm going to put on a brown stocking cap, and when people ask me what I am, I'm going to say I'm a shit." Oh, boy, did we laugh. It was the kind of thing that seems brilliant when you're 18 years old and half drunk. It was a Friday night. After we'd had more than a few beers, a bunch of us piled in the cars and went to a diner down the road called, if you can believe it, Dynamite. Lewisburg's biggest little diner, it called itself. As we were all sitting around the table laughing about Parker's costume idea, I had an inspiration. "How about if I get a toilet seat for you to put around your neck?" That did it. Everybody thought it was the greatest idea in the world. While they were howling with laughter and banging on the table, I went into the men's room. I'm not bragging about this. Started trying to pry the seat off the toilet. But it wouldn't come off. I pulled and pulled, and the damn thing wouldn't budge. Finally, I yanked the son of a bitch, and the whole toilet bowl came up off the floor. There was water all over the place. Water was running out under the door of the men's room. And meanwhile, my pals were raising hell in the diner. A couple of them did damage. And Sadie, the owner, called the police, and the state cops came, and off we went. They took about 10 or 12 of us in, booked us, then released us on our own recognizance. And, of course, the police notified Bucknell about what happened. Damage had been done to the diner, and Sadie was pressing charges. The dean of men, a guy named Mal Musser, ironically, he was a Sigma Chi alumnus, called us in, more or less got to the bottom of the story, and effectively encouraged David and me to take the hit for everybody else. Musser felt if there were fewer kids involved, the whole incident would be less prominent. Now, was it fair for David and me to take the fall when other kids were also guilty? Not really, but the unfairness of it didn't make my own behavior one bit less egregious. I'd screwed up big time, and oh boy, I was scared. Look, Musa says to David and me, you kids go work it out with the justice of the peace, and we'll talk when you get back. That made me feel a little better. So David and I went to the justice of the peace, his name was Paul Showalter, and pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct. Okay, that's a misdemeanor, Showalter said. You each have to pay $37.50 plus damages. That was a lot of money. We came up with it. We go back to the campus, and we walk into Mal Musser's office, and we tell him that we did it, that it was all over, and he said, fine. Then he says, go back to your rooms, pack your stuff, and get out of here. What do you mean, get out of here? I said. You're out of Bucknell, Musser said. I started to cry. My first thought was about my mother. This would kill her, I thought. David was crying, too. Musser's office was in Roberts Hall. David and I ran across the quad to the admissions office, which was in Carnegie Library. There was a guy in the admissions office by the name of Fitz Wallen. Fitz was also a Sigma Chi alumnus, and he was the chapter advisor. David and I went in, both in tears, and I told him what we had done. Come on with me, Walling said. So the two of us follow him until we go back across the quad to Musser's office. And Fitz says to Musser's secretary, I want to see him right now with these kids. Before she has a chance to answer, he stalks into Musser's office with us behind him. I know what they did, and what they did is wrong, Walling said to Musser. But I also know they were not the only ones doing it, and they took the fall for your purposes. So you can do whatever you want to them, but you're not throwing them out. It was a hell of a speech. Musser nodded, okay, he said. Then he turns to us. You can go home at the end of the semester, he said. But after that, and for the next year, you're going to spend all your vacations here on campus, raking leaves and doing whatever else the grounds department wants you to do. Great, I only had one problem. What was I going to tell my mother about not coming home over spring break or Thanksgiving, for God's sake? I called her up. Mom, I said, you can't believe what's happened. I'm so excited about my studies. What do you mean, she says. Mom, I really want to catch up, I said. So next time I have time off, I'm going to stay up here to study. My professor will be here then. It'll help me get a jump on my classes. I could hear her sigh of relief on the other end of the phone. I've been praying to St. Anthony every night that you would get serious, and he's answered my prayers, my sweet mother said. She went to her grave, and my father went to his, never knowing what really happened. Many years later, though, it came up in an interesting way. One of my closest friends, a man named Walter Buckley, used to run the Bethlehem Steel Pension Fund. When Bethlehem Steel went under, Walter and his associates started a money management firm, and I agreed to invest $500,000 in it. That was 25% of their initial capitalization. One day, Walter calls me up. He's a very proper WASP, very proper. It's hard to believe we could be as close as we are. If you looked at him and looked at me, you'd think, holy shit, opposites really do attract. Anyway, Walter has something to say to me, but I can tell he doesn't know how to get it out. Finally, he says, we had to file papers with the Attorney General of the state of Pennsylvania to get our license. And because you own 25% of the firm, we had to submit your information. I knew right away where this was going. And they told you I have a criminal record, I said. I'm sure it's a mistake, Walter said. No, no, it's not a mistake, I said. I told him the whole sordid tale. I pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor, and I paid a $37.50 fine and damages, I said. Did I hear Walter laughing on the other end of the line? In the end, they got their license. I wonder if it had an asterisk on it. End of my freshman year, June 1954, I got home from college, and a friend of mine told me there was a party over in Manhasset. Manhasset was not Roslyn Heights. Manhasset was the right side of the tracks. Nice houses, nice lawns, nice cars. I walked into this party, and I saw this girl. She was tall, blonde. She had on white Bermuda shorts and a blue shirt with a collar, short sleeve. She had ballerina slippers on. That's what they used to wear then. I talked to her for 5 minutes, and it was nice. Then I was moving around the party, and all of a sudden she was gone. I said to the girl whose house we were in, "Hey, that gal who was here, she told me she was going to give me her phone number, and she left before she gave it to me." Maybe I was fibbing a bit, but this girl gave me the tall girl's phone number. This was Monday night. The next morning I started my summer job, working as a day laborer for a Long Island contractor called Lizza and Sons. They were building the section of the Long Island Expressway from the city line to Shelter Rock Road in Manhasset. It was a long-term job, and I was thrilled to have the work. I had to join the Labor's Union, Local 1298. At lunch the next day, I went to a payphone at a gas station on the corner and called a tall girl from the party. The call was a nickel, as I remember. Her mother answered the phone, and I asked for Elaine. That was the girl's name. She picked up, and I said, "Hi. Who are you?" she asked. I said, "I spoke to you last night at the party. Would you like to go on a date with me this Friday night?" "I can't," she said. "Why not?" I asked. "I just don't want to." What could I say to that? "Okay," I told her, and went back to work. The next day I called her again. Same answer. Maybe she'd been told nice girls don't get picked up by boys, even if it's at a party. There were different standards then than there are now. So on Thursday I called her again. I said, "Look, you go out with me tomorrow night, and if you don't have a great time, you'll never see me or hear from me again." "I've got to ask my mother," she said. She was 16, I was 18. She got back on the phone and said, "I can go out, but I have to be home by 11:30. I said, "11:30? Conrad Janis doesn't play the Saints until midnight." There was a place down in the East Village then called the Central Plaza, and there was a guy who played the trombone who later became a movie actor. His name was Conrad Janis. It was Dixieland Jazz, which was a rage then, and the Central Plaza was a beer hall. You'd get pitchers of beer for a buck and a quarter, and you'd see girls flopping over in their seats, passed out. "I've got to be home by 11:30, she said. "All right." We went with a high school friend of mine and his date. I borrowed my father's car and went to pick her up. She lived in a nice house in a nice part of Manhasset. Her father, Dick Abbey, worked on Wall Street. They belonged to a country club, the whole deal. I'll never forget the sight of Elaine when she came to the door. She had a dress on with a crinoline. These things girls used to wear that made their dresses stick out. She looked beautiful. And we drove down to the East Village and listened to the music and drank beer and had a ball. We laughed like hell. We got there about 9 and we left at 10:30 so Elaine could get home on time. My friend was fine with it. We drove back to Long Island. I dropped my friend and his date off. Then I took Elaine home. I walked her up to her front door and said, "I had a great time." "So did I," she said. "I'll give you a call," I said. Then I turned around to leave. I remember they had a slate sidewalk that went from the front door to the driveway, which was on the side. I got in my car, and before I backed out of the driveway with the window open, I said to her, "I'm going to marry you." She laughed and shook her head at me. Then she put her key in the door and went in. And you want to know the crazy thing? She never dated anybody else ever again, neither did I. The beginning of any relationship is physical attraction. But I also enjoy the fact that this girl came across as carefree. I was a little wild myself. In fact, after we started seeing each other, Elaine met a girlfriend of mine from Roslyn. Not a relationship, just a friend, who said, "I understand you're dating Ken Langone." "Yes," Elaine said. "Hell, he's nuts," this gal said. "I don't know about that," Elaine told her. "All I know is every time I'm with him, all I do is laugh." She was carefree and I was carefree. It was a great time to be young, 10 years after World War II, and things were starting to happen in America. Big cars, jet planes, Elvis Presley, though I was never into rock and roll. She was from Manhasset, I was from Roslyn, but I never felt like an interloper around Elaine. We were nuts about each other. We enjoyed each other. We had a great time together. We'd go to movies or we'd go to Jones Beach. Cheap, simple stuff. We had many of the same interests. She liked sports, so did I. I had run cross-country in high school, but Elaine was a much better athlete than I was. She was a very good tennis player, a 7-handicap golfer. I remember going to watch her play in a high school basketball game while I was in college, and she was good. She had a lot of friends. She was very popular. But the main thing I liked about her was that she was a free spirit. She didn't judge me, and I didn't judge her. We just enjoyed each other, and we still do. Supply and demand goes through everything in life. Early on, I caught the fact that if you have a special talent or if you have something unique that provokes people to do something that you can make a profit on, that's a good thing. Every 2 weeks while I was at Bucknell, my dad used to send me a $16 check for spending money, $8 a week, a big stretch for him and a tough budget for me. Man, I had to go out and kill to eat, but necessity is the mother of invention. Late in my freshman year, I hit on an idea. I remember that as soon as I'd get to Bucknell as freshman, a lot of rich kids, practically everybody who wasn't me was rich, were buying stationery with their names printed on it or the Bucknell seal on it. Some guys waited until they pledged the fraternity, then put the emblem of their fraternity on it. I thought, how could I make some money selling stationery? The light bulb went on. Freshman orientation. For orientation at Bucknell, you had to wear a beanie and a kind of sandwich board, two sheets of white cardboard, one on your chest and one on your back, connected by a couple of pieces of string over your shoulders, with your name and hometown printed on each side. It was a little humiliating. That was part of the point. The first couple of days you're there, you haven't met anybody yet, and you're melancholy. You miss your high school friends. They've all gone someplace else. I thought that would be my moment to strike. L.G. Balfour was a company in Massachusetts that made college rings and caps and gowns, and they also had a stationery division. Before I started my sophomore year, I got them to send me samples, and I put the samples on a piece of cardboard. I got all set up a week before freshman orientation. As soon as the freshmen arrived, I'd go into their dorms with my sample board and say, look, you're going to be writing a lot to your friends. I'd remind them that a long-distance call was 65 cents for 3 minutes. That was a lot of money then. I'd say, let's see, you have how many friends? 10. You're going to write to them 2-3 times a week? They're nodding. I can see they're homesick and blue. Okay, I tell them. Here's what you'll need for your freshman year, but you get a price break if you order enough. I guess you might say it was exploitative. I made damn sure I got their check or money order right away, and here's why. Within 2 weeks after they got to school, they'd forgotten their friends at home, they'd made new friends, they were going to Russia fraternity, writing letters was the last thing on their minds. I had guys tell me years later, you son of a bitch, I still have boxes of that fucking stationery. Suddenly, supply and demand was more than a theory to me. Sophomore year, when I began dating Elaine, I used to come home most weekends. A Bucknell guy from my neck of the woods had a car, and four of us would ride with him. We'd pay him $2 apiece each way for gas. On Sunday nights, we'd drive back to school, and sometimes we'd stop at a store on 42nd Street called Tie City and pick up some neckties. Everybody at Bucknell had to wear a tie and jacket at dinner and in the fraternity houses. Those were different times. Back in those days, all the college kids used to wear what you call rep ties, the silk neckties with diagonal stripes. Tie City sold cheap rep ties for $1 apiece. You knew they were cheap because of how easily they wrinkled. With Tie City neckties, you learned never to untie the knot, because those damn wrinkles would never come out. You just loosen the thing and pull it over your head. Anyway, I used to buy a box of 100 ties, all different colors, bring them back to Bucknell on Sunday night, then on Monday hit the freshman dorms and sell them for $1.50, $1.75 apiece. I could make $50 to $75 on a box. Further adventures in entrepreneurship. There was more. I knew a guy in my fraternity by the name of Matt Sleeper. And Matt Sleeper, who was a senior when I was a sophomore, was the R.J. Reynolds representative for Bucknell. R.J. Reynolds was a tobacco company that manufactured Camels and their new filtered cigarette, Winston. Salem would come later. Reynolds paid Matt $25 a month, plus all the cigarettes he wanted to distribute its products on campus. Every month, Reynolds would send Sleeper a big cardboard box containing 20 cartons of cigarettes. Each wax-sealed carton held 25 cellophane-wrapped four-packs of Camels and Winston. And all Matt had to do was to go to the fraternity dining rooms and put one of these four-packs at each place, or go to the dorm, knock on the doors, and hand the cigarettes out. He was giving them away, not selling them. R.J. Reynolds was just building business. Matt was about to graduate, and I wanted that job. I said, "Matt, how do I get it?" "You've got to pay me," he said. "Whoever I recommend gets the job." I asked him how much. He said, $55. $55 was real money in 1954, but I would make it back in the first 2 months. First, though, I would have to pass muster with O.R. Zimmerman. Zimmerman was R.J. Reynolds' executive for college accounts. He worked out of Harrisburg, covering dozens of college campuses, and he visited his reps frequently. And Zimmerman was coming to Bucknell to meet with me, and Matt Sleeper told me, "You've got to smoke." "What do you mean?" I asked. "Oh, yeah," Matt says, "you've got to smoke. When the guy comes to the interview, we're going to have lunch, and he'll tell you about what the job entails and so forth. Then he'll decide, but you'll have my recommendation. After the meal, Zimmerman is going to offer you a cigarette. And if you tell him you don't smoke, he ain't going to hire you." Matt smoked, of course, but I didn't. So a friend of mine taught me how to inhale. He taught me on Winston's, which had the filter. I got so I could just manage. So O.R. Zimmerman comes to Bucknell, and he and Matt and I go to lunch at the Bison, this place on campus where you'd go after class to have a Coke and French fries. We'd sit in a booth. We eat, we talk, and it's all going well. Then Zimmerman whiffs out a pack of Camels and offers me one. I light up and I inhale, and all of a sudden, the, pardon my French, fucking room starts to spin. I just barely got "excuse me" out and ran to the bathroom and was sicker than I'd ever been in my life. Cleaned up, washed my face, went back to the table, and long story short, I got the job and never smoked another cigarette. Elaine and I got married in September 1956, the beginning of my senior year at Bucknell, and we were as poor as church mice. Elaine was making a big bet on me. Who knew if I'd ever amount to anything? She was going to go to nursing school, and then she married me, and she didn't go to nursing school. Before the wedding, my father said to me, "Your mother and I are going to give you the same as we've given you every year. As for the rest, you're on your own." He was really adamant that you shouldn't get married unless you could afford to support your wife. Fathers didn't do that for sons. Italian macho mentality. At that point in my life, all I knew was that I wanted to make money. And where did you make money? Wall Street. My wife's father worked on Wall Street in institutional investing at Shears and Hamill. But that was just a lot of words to me then. All I knew about Wall Street was that was where you bought and sold stocks and bonds. In other words, I knew nothing. But I read Fortune religiously every month in the library at Bucknell. I was intrigued by mergers. I was intrigued by companies growing and how they financed their growth. I don't know why I was so fascinated by Wall Street. I wasn't from an Ivy League school. I really had no family connections. Elaine's dad and I didn't sit around discussing municipal bonds. It was all just exciting to me in a way I couldn't put my finger on yet. Elaine and I barely had enough money to see us from September to January, enough for food, rent on a little apartment on Main Street off campus, and one semester's tuition for me. What that meant was I had to figure out a way to do two semesters in one and graduate early. So I went to see the dean of students, Dr. Coleman. I needed to get his permission to take the extra credits. He wasn't encouraging. "I just don't think you can do this much work at once," he told me. Sorry, I told him, that if he wouldn't let me take the extra classes, it probably made the most sense for me to drop out right away. Why spend the money on my second or last semester, then leave in January, a semester short of graduating? I could go to New York now and get a job, I told him, and save the tuition money. He shook his head. "Okay," he said, "I'll let you take the extra classes, but you're asking for trouble." Maybe I am, I said, but I've got no choices. Coleman had an assistant, Martha Henderson. She had a desk outside his office like a secretary would,